ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
If I had to pick one word to describe America's history in the Middle East, I'd probably go with mistake.
But it was, the Americans believe, all a dreadful mistake.
The backpackers crossed the poorly marked border by mistake.
The war in Iraq was a big, fat mistake.
So why is it happening again? I'm Matt Bevan, and on my show, if you're listening, we actually try to learn from the world's mistakes. Find us on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Once a fringe party, One Nation is now the most popular political party in Australia, according to a series of polls. Those polling highs have come with more scrutiny of the minor party and its leader as Australia assesses whether One Nation could be a legitimate party of government. Today, ABC election analyst emeritus Anthony Green on what the data tells us and the big tests ahead for One Nation. Welcome to Politics Now. Hi, I'm Patricia Carvalison. Anthony Green, it's brilliant to have you back on the podcast. Welcome.
Thank you.
Now, you joined me for an episode late last year looking at the current rise of One Nation and historic parallels. We're going to link that in the show notes. But we thought it would be important to revisit that because a lot has happened since. Like, it's undebatable that it's been seismic, the shift since. So for this special edition of the podcast, I want to have a look at where One Nation is at the moment and some of the big tests ahead for the party before the next federal election. But first, let's just start on where we are at the moment, because polling for One Nation has reached a high watermark, hasn't it?
Yes, and last time we did this discussion, it was a question of whether when we got to an election, would they match the opinion polls? And we've now got evidence that the polls are right. Where at first you're saying, is this a real phenomena? They are now leading on first preferences, but that's at about 30% of the vote. That's not anything which is going to deliver them government in their own right. They've gone up from 6% at the last general election to that figure. It's been matched by those recent polls. And it's a question now of, what we're seeing increasingly is One Nation's going up, Labor's vote has slipped, and the coalition's vote has just collapsed.
Collapsed is exactly the point. So let's go to that collapse. This surge in One Nation support. In our last conversation, clearly a lot of the vote was shifting from one right-wing party, the Liberal or the National parties, to the One Nation column. That's part of the story now, but it's not the whole story, right?
No, it's not. I mean, there is some Labor votes leaking in certain types of seats. I think you also have to be cautious with the polls. What you may be seeing is Labor's vote being more effectively able to turn into seats, is that the Labor vote is probably just completely disappearing in the country. It's been sliding into low double digits for years. It may be that a lot of that, I mean, we saw that in Farrer. Labor got about 12, 15% at the general election. That didn't all go to the Greens or the Independents at the by-election. So it's clearly some of that country vote has gone to One Nation as well, you suspect. But that's different from the cities. And certainly the Farrer by-election, I don't think, is a good guide to how votes will be going in the cities.
Now, Anthony, what isn't captured in many of the polls is whether the vote share will translate into seats One Nation would need to win to form government, right?
That's right. And we've seen some attempts with what they call MRP. But it's an attempt to try and turn votes into seats. So they, from big polls, they sort of capture as many votes as they can across all seats and then factor in demographics, past voting trends to try and turn it into seats. But it's more than a bit speculative, especially in we've now got three-party politics. You're having to try and pick, well, where's the Liberal Party vote going to collapse? And One Nation will be in second or first place. Where will Labor finish third? There's a lot of variables going into that sort of analysis. But, clearly, if the coalition is under 20%, the chances of them winning more than about 15 seats is unlikely. It's because they'll just finish third in nearly all the seats that they currently hold. And One Nation will sweep up that, especially in rural areas. So that's what we're seeing. We're seeing the election at the moment, if the polls continue like this, it's turning into Labor versus One Nation, and the coalition may just be like the National Party to the coalition. There'll be a source of preferences or a buttress for a non-Labor majority.
So I just want to go to an idea that we've heard for years that I really want to interrogate with you, and that's this notion that our compulsory preferential voting system always skews to the centre and allegedly, we were told, deals with some of the more extremes in politics. Is that now a fiction, or is it more that One Nation has changed its kind of reputation through a couple of, you know, electoral tests to be seen as more of a mainstream party?
I think compulsory voting definitely has an impact. The fact that everybody turns out to vote. I would suspect One Nation may potentially do better under voluntary voting, because there'd be Liberal and Labor voters who just wouldn't turn up. And what we know is that with voluntary voting in other countries, it's the supporters of the party that's going to lose over tendency to not turn up. It's one of the reasons why parties do really badly sometimes under voluntary voting. But in preferential voting, it's been stable in Australia because there's been two dominant parties of the centre, centre-right and centre-left, the Coalition and Labor. And as long as they hogged the middle ground of politics, we saw the Democrats as a small centrist party once upon a time and their votes split easily. But the parties that have emerged on the outside of the centre, One Nation on the populist right and the Greens on the left, their votes in the end nearly always flow back to the centre. But if One Nation is outpolling the Coalition, these votes don't flow to the Coalition in the centre because they're just not getting enough votes. It ends up with the Liberal Party preferences flowing outwards to One Nation. Now, we saw back in the 90s when initially the Liberal Party decided not to direct preferences to One Nation, to do them to Labor, is that that sort of drove down the One Nation vote to an extent. But also it meant that they got no foothold. They didn't get enough votes anywhere to finish ahead of the Liberal Party. I think some of that was a specific issue back in the 90s, which is John Howard switched to talking about the economy and completely wrong-footed One Nation in 1998. But it's in a situation now where the Liberal Party really is in a bind. If it doesn't direct preferences to One Nation wouldn't direct preferences back, and the Liberal Party would be close to being wiped out. And the National Party's in the same position. So to try and just survive, they feel they have to do some sort of deal with One Nation. Because as it currently stands, they are not getting more votes than One Nation. We saw in South Australia, there were many more seats, half of the seats with One Nation finishing second and only a third with the Liberal finishing second. They have to try and deal with this because just directing preferences away from One Nation may not be a tactic that works anymore.
Well, you've gone to where I want to go, Anthony. Of course you have. You're so smart. Polling is just that. It's just polling, right? Elections are, of course, the real test. People can say all sorts of things to pollsters because there's a vibe, there's a mood. It's sometimes very circular too. You hear it and then you say it, okay? But then an election is a real choice and is a private ballot, and that's when you actually make that decision. We've got two recent measures of One Nation and how they've performed at the ballot box. The Farrer by-election, of course, which is a federal, you know, seat, national seat. And we have the South Australian election that you just referred to. Let's go through what we learnt from those. We'll start with the South Australian election because that was One Nation's first electoral test since they surged in the polls. And while, of course, you know, Labor, that was very popular, Peter Malinauskas is a very popular premier, that there's no doubt that Labor's done well. Even Malinauskas has been very clear that there were lessons in that election, even with the strong election results for Labor. One Nation made some significant gains. Walk me through what you observed and what you think it means.
Well, what we've always had a two-party system. You're able to line up all the seats on a continuum, a one-dimensional line from coalitionists to Labourness. So you've always been able to use two-party preferred that way. In South Australia, we suddenly had a second dimension added to that, which was the support for One Nation. And it was distributed differently from the traditional Labor versus Liberal count. So that One Nation didn't do well in those really traditional Liberal seats in the centre of Adelaide along the edge of the hills. But they did much better in safe Labor seats in the outer suburbs, especially north of Grand Junction Road, the Elizabeth conurbation, which is those sort of working class suburbs of northern Adelaide. So that it's rather peculiar that there's, if you look at the Labor-Liberal contest, there was a 6% swing to Labor. If you look at the Labor-One Nation contest, there was a 7% swing against Labor. So there's this peculiar levelling out of the margins of all the seats in South Australia because One Nation had appeal in those areas where Labor did well. But this was also at the same time the Liberal Party vote just disappeared in those seats. So not only did they sweep up all the Liberal, because, I mean, traditionally what One Nation did was they would poll well in safe Labor seats, but basically replace the One Nation, the Liberal vote, is they picked up, you know, what in Britain they call the working class Tories. Mm. But in South Australia, they went beyond the working class Tories and started to pick up the working class Labor voters as well. And that would be the concern. They didn't lose any of those seats to One Nation, but there were certainly a number of them where the margin was much closer. The other interesting thing was to do with preferences, that Liberal preferences were slightly weaker to One Nation than One Nation preferences to the Liberal Party. Liberal preferences flowed about 65 to 70% to One Nation, but One Nation's preferences flowed consistently about 70% to the Liberal Party. So there was a slightly weaker flow of Liberal preferences to One Nation than the reverse, which is interesting because the Liberals did direct recommend preferences for One Nation. One Nation didn't make a recommendation with the How to Votes, but they got a stronger flow of preferences. So I think that tells you something about that support base. Who finished third had a big say over when went on to win. So it's interesting, you know, One Nation got 23% of the vote, the Liberals 19%. One Nation outpolled the Liberal in the country areas. It was a sweeping victory for Labor. Their vote was barely distributed. Labor only holds two seats out of Adelaide, and in most of the other seats, their vote just disappeared. But in Adelaide, their vote was clearly the highest, and there was no way in most seats they were going to be run down on preferences, and that's why Labor, with 37.5% of the vote, won, I think it's 35 seats. They won a clear majority of seats with what looks like a relatively low primary vote. One factor I would say there is that, and people who just look at the primary votes forget this. So Green preferences flow consistently about 85 to 90% to Labor. You can almost add the Labor and Green vote together to get one number for the left. But on the other side of politics, the Coalition and One Nation preferences are not nearly as strong. So you can't just add them together. You've got to take account that there's about a third of their preferences leak across the divide. So some of those polls showing Labor, you know, doing really badly, when you factor in this flow of preferences later in the count, is Labor might be doing slightly better. And I suspect also their vote is more strategically better positioned to turn into seats. There aren't that many seats that Labor holds outside of the metropolitan areas. So there's not that many Labor seats which would be at risk. And the question is, will One Nation break into the cities?
Yes, and that is a huge question. I want to park that question because I definitely want to explore it. It's a very big one. One Nation's success at the South Australian election, of course, was quickly followed by One Nation's win at the Farah by-election. And that was an extraordinary win. I mean, it was a strong and thumping win, in my view. It was not some sort of merely, you know, getting over the line, let's vote, let's count, keep counting the votes kind of night. It was emphatic and clear, that vote. That, of course, was former opposition leader Susan Lee's seat. She held it for 25 years. It is a deeply conservative seat, always has been. But what did you make of One Nation's David Farley winning it comfortably? What did that by-election tell us? With all the caveats that it's a by-election, the Coalition was a bit of a shambles at the time, all of that clearly is part of the story. But the fact that he was able to win so emphatically.
Some of the victory must be put down to him and the issues he represents. In the western end of the electorate, irrigation is an issue. And access to water, conservation, you know, with withdrawals of water to keep the river flowing and clean and you know, swamps looking good and trees going well and birds nesting. But a lot of people who work at the West, live at the end of the western end of the electorate and are involved in farming, they really object to the way that they don't get access to the water they used to do. And David Farley has been involved in that issue for many years. He's well known in the district. So he was the perfect candidate for that seat. He didn't do as well in Albury, which is the biggest regional centre. That's where the independent was and where the Liberal candidate was from. So some of that may be candidate issues, but I think you've got to consider that he was a good candidate, but he easily outpolled the Coalition. And you would think that if that result was reflected across the rest of rural Australia, the Liberals and Nationals would be wiped out in the country. And that's what that result tells you. It doesn't tell you that, as Barnaby Joyce said, they can come for Western Sydney next. As I said, One Nation didn't do as well in Albury, which was the biggest regional centre. Admittedly, there was an independent there. It's not the sort of electorate that decides Australian elections. For all the people saying this is the most telling one to see, it told us a lot about how One Nation are doing. Because there was no Labour candidate, it tells us nothing about how One Nation will go against Labour in a rural, in an urban seat.
You mentioned earlier, and I said I wanted to revisit it, so I think we've got to revisit it, and that's the metropolitan argument. I've heard Cos Samaras from Redbridge make this point that it's really, obviously the majority of seats in this country is still in the cities. That's where our population are very heavy, and there One Nation has to make inroads. Now, one of the things that, for instance, Labor strategists have been telling me, I just come off the back of a week in Canberra, I've spoken to a lot of people. They say that one thing that's changed about the One Nation vote is that it's broader based. It's not in narrow categories like it used to be. We're seeing some of this in the polling. For instance, women are taking more of an interest in One Nation. What does that mean for the cities, though? Like, where could potentially One Nation make inroads?
Well, I was last week mapping how One Nation went in the upper house election at the last New South Wales election. And when you draw that map, they did really well in all the country. And there's this very dark halo around Sydney. It sort of runs from down south around Camden, which is in the federal seat of Hume, through Lindsay, the federal seat of Lindsay, onto the Central Coast and up to the Hunter Valley. That's where One Nation vote at the last New South Wales election was strongest. And I would expect that's where it would be strongest at any general election. And it would be strong enough to challenge Labor in those sorts of seats, which is on the edges of Sydney. But when you look at the map, that vote deteriorates the further you get towards the city. So it's a very much an outer suburban phenomena. And it has to withstand 2 years up until the next federal election to be translated into seats, though. Could be interesting. We'll talk about New South Wales election a little bit later. And the similar sort of pattern you'll see in every city, those outer suburban seats where people are seen to be paying more for petrol, more for travel, more for, you know, they're having to move to the edge of the cities. All those things where people feel they're having to work harder and harder, it's taking longer to get to work, where they're seeing they're not getting the same sort of services that, you know, in the inner city where there's longer established hospitals and schools. Those services tend to be retained, where the rapidly growing areas are needing the new services. So I think that's where you'll see in the cities, you'll see those sorts of areas where people have got a bit more of a struggle making their, what we used to call the mortgage belt to some extent. But on top of the mortgage belt, they are overlain by very different demographics. So if I'm familiar with Sydney, so I'll discuss that. It's clearest in Sydney. You've got a seat like Hume, which is Angus Taylor's seat, and Lindsay, which is the federal seat. They're based on Camden, which is Hume, and Penrith, which is Sydney. The similar sort of demographics on the Central Coast. They're not as multicultural, not quite as high a migrant population as the rest of Sydney. So I think there's a real difference between how some of those seats will behave as opposed to Camden and Penrith were the areas of Sydney where the most protests about building a mosque, for instance. It's sort of been rolling for about 15 years. There's a real difference between that, and you look at Chifley, which is right next door to the federal seat of Lindsay, covers Mount Druitt, Housing Commission Estate, huge population of people who are migrants or and different backgrounds. Those two seats will behave very differently for that reason, even though the demographics are quite different. So, I mean, there's a lot. I mean, Cos and those who do this individual polling will be able to sort of cite the categories of voters behave particularly well. But I think the easiest one to look at is proportion of people who speak a language other than English at home, proportion who were born overseas. And in some of the seats I've mentioned, like Hume and Lindsay, the proportion of overseas born is lower, and it's also of a different composition.
That's fascinating. I want to go to the Victorian election now, because that's coming up in November. It's the next test, if you like, a real election. And it will really look at whether One Nation can translate some of its success into a more diverse electorate. Now, Victoria has historically been seen as quite a progressive state, but I think We've got now a very old Labor government that's very unpopular, and that's, you know, shown in all the polling. But I can tell you anecdotally in Victoria, it's really clear that the government is a bit stinky. Like, you feel like it's on the nose. And I'm saying that it's an educated comment. Like, it's, I hear that from the left and the right. Quite broadly, it's an unpopular government. Now, the Victorian Liberals have spent a long time in the political wilderness. They're trying to get themselves together. But that's kind of, well, difficult. They've had a few shenanigans this week that I think will make it even more difficult. But just tell me, is this the most consequential election in your view? I mean, is this the one to watch to really see whether, for instance, One Nation will snag seats off Labor, will snag seats off the Liberals who are on the nose? How do you see it?
This is a consequential election. Before the rise of One Nation, this is the change of government election. This is, after 12 years, the government should be in difficulty, and it wasn't in difficulty because the Liberal Party has been too busy suing each other and various other shenanigans which have been going on in the party. And then suddenly One Nation's emerged. I'm going to throw back a little bit here to 1999 when Steve Brax came to office. That was a very unusual election because the Labor Party won regional seats. They won all the Bendigo and Ballarat seats, the Geelong seats, the Morwell. They won seats in regional areas which they'd never won before, and they have hung on to those seats ever since, state and federal level. And holding those seats has made it very difficult for the Liberal Party and the National Party to get back into government since. And when they did get in 2010, it was only very narrowly. And there's this divide in Melbourne where the Liberals have not won a seat north or west of the Yarra this century. It's just astonishing. They just are incapable of winning those seats over the last 25 years. We saw the Werribee by-election 2 years ago. I think it was before the federal election. They didn't win Werribee by-election. It was set up for them to win, and they didn't pick a good candidate, and they lost. And they talked about winning the federal seats of Hawke and Gorton at the last federal election. They didn't win them. They didn't swing
as much.
Yeah,
and they're very working-class seats, yeah. Right?
So all of Western Melbourne is more working-class than the rest of the city. Some of the areas are very heavily multicultural migrant seats as well. So the Liberal Party's had no ability to get into those seats. There's resentment building up in Western Melbourne. For instance, Labor buttressed itself in office by upgrading all the railways to southeast Melbourne, where all the marginal seats were, fixing the tram things there. But, say, Melton still isn't on the Metropolitan Rail Network, and it's out in the western suburbs of Melbourne. There were growing resentments at the last election to do with COVID lockdowns as well, which was causing the Labor vote to drop. But the Liberal Party being incapable of winning those seats, is One Nation going to do that? Are they the ones, if Labor can't win those 20-odd seats west of the Yarra, then their numbers in the parliament will be hugely reduced. But if they can hang on to them, they are still a viable opposition. It seems I can't see how Labor can win a majority. They might end up with the most seats in parliament, but would they want to try and govern in that situation? The Liberals and Nationals and One Nation are going to have to do some sort of deal on preferences to defeat Labor. But who's going to end up with the largest of the non-Labor parties, and who's going to form government? Do they have to form a coalition? There's a whole bunch of questions there, which are things to consider as we come up to the election.
Yeah, there's so many different ways that this could end. And of course, you know, November's a long way away in political terms. So, you know, watch that space. But we could end up with a Labor minority government or even a One Nation Liberal coalition. Now, that is an argument that's at the centre of the Labor research, that they are trying to build a scare campaign for those who are, you know, dancing with these ideas that you're going to end up with a chaotic One Nation coalition government. They're trying to build a story, Anthony, that basically the Liberals won't govern alone anymore, that they will have to govern with One Nation. And that is meant to evoke kind of this idea of dysfunction and worry for people and then entrench Labor. But is it a fallacy, or is it actually based on some truth, based on the numbers we're seeing, that actually it is a real live proposition?
Well, you'd imagine One Nation will win quite a number of seats outside of Melbourne, rural seats, regional seats. If they had a few more seats in Melbourne, you know, unless the Labor vote completely collapsed, there's a really strong possibility One Nation could get more seats than the Liberal Party. The National Party may well be wiped out in rural Victoria. And if that happens, I mean, the Liberals, I think Liberals have not tried governing on their own since the defeat of the Liberal Party in 1982. I mean, in that long era of Bolte and Hamer, they did govern on their own, but nowadays they have to. Now Labor is more electable. The Liberals have to have a coalition partner from the country to win. And after this election, that may be One Nation rather than the Nationals.
Which is extraordinary, right? I mean, you know, as we're doing this podcast because we did the last one together where that seemed a lot less likely. Things have changed so quickly. Are you surprised by some of these changes?
I am, that in a state like Victoria, One Nation could outpoll the Liberals. I think the last poll, they didn't outpoll the Liberals. But I think there might be a problem, the coalition. But I think there's a problem there of trying to pick what's going to happen later this year. I still have my doubts that One Nation could outpoll the coalition in Victoria. It's a state where One Nation's always done worse than every other state. But we'll see what happens.
Yeah. That's always been the view, and that's why Victoria is so interesting. You know, that's why I mentioned the Massachusetts of Australia, seen as such a progressive state. If One Nation is able to make significant inroads, it'll be quite the story.
Yeah, there's also two other consequences out of this. The first is to do with four-year terms. Victoria has fixed four-year terms. They've become standard across all the states. Fixed four-year terms were introduced to stop strong governments calling early elections. But we haven't really had the situation where you have a weak government with not a really strong control of the parliament. South Australia had a couple of minority Labor governments where they enticed ex-Liberals and Nationals into the cabinet. We saw the Napthine and Baillieu governments only had a two-seat majority. And in their last year after a defection, they really struggled to hang on to parliament. But they couldn't call an early election. It's very difficult to call an early election. You have to go through a baton change procedure. So that's, if One Nation and the Liberals end up forming government, it's very hard for them. They can't use an election to resolve a problem without actually going through a 2 or 3 week procedure where they call a baton change. And only after you've done that can the governor issue writs for an election. So it's going to be interesting politics if they have to try and govern together. Probably the best hope for Labor is to lose in such a manner that it still has a reasonable number of seats. Mm. And neither the coalition does not have a majority in its own right. If you're a Labor activist and you don't think you're going to win, that's the scenario you want to hang on to as many seats as possible, then see what happens on the other side. The other thing I would say is it is a huge test for One Nation, Victoria, because if they end up in government, at the moment they're outside the glasshouse chucking rocks. Mm. If they're in government, they'll be inside, and you know, throwing rocks around is not the thing you do when you're in government in a glasshouse. So it'll be interesting to see how, and if it doesn't work with them in government, that has consequences for the next federal election.
Oh, it does. And that is exactly, can I say, I'm so glad you've said that, because, you know, you're the smart guy that knows all the numbers. I talk to lots of people and I can share vibes with you, and I can tell you what the vibe is in federal Labor. The federal Labor vibe, even Victorians think, and I'm going to say it because I've heard enough of them say it, they think this Allan government stinks. They think that they probably will lose, and they hope that if it happens that way and One Nation is successful in some way, that what happens is that people are able to see what a hot mess it is and then not vote for One Nation at a federal level. That is their ideal scenario. And you can see why it is their ideal scenario, isn't it? If you see this scenario unfold and One Nation does look dysfunctional if they get sort of a sense of power, and we don't know if that'll happen, they might be wonderful, we don't know. But if that does eventuate, then that is the sort of thing you can point to if you're Anthony Albanese, right?
Certainly there are times when nobody, as someone said, nobody, it's never a good, no one ever wants to lose an election, but there are times when it's a good time to lose an election. Labor in New South Wales got to the fourth term after winning the 2007 election and were just a disaster and wiped out for a decade in 2011. And in Tasmania, where they won a fourth term in 2010, lost in 2014, and haven't been near government since. So depending how bad the result is, if you got re-elected and had a terrible term, you're out of office for a long time.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So sometimes it's about you're thinking about the rebuild already, the generational change, the next phase of your political party's fortunes, really. Let's go to the New South Wales election, which is in March 2027, which feels far away but also feels very close depending on how you feel about life and time. So there's a lot to play out. We've got a really strong premier, I think, who's, you know, reasonably popular in the Labor Premier, Chris Minns. Not universally. He's done some controversial things, but I think he is a pretty strong Labor figure. But as you said, after the Farrah by-election, Pauline Hanson and Barnaby Joyce made it clear they were coming for Western Sydney seats. I think, just, you know, in terms of my analysis, that Chris Minns has been very smart about how he talks about One Nation, how he talks about the grievances coming from that party. He seems to me to be all over it. And that kind of puts him probably in a good position. But what do you see that broadly? I mean, we're a bit of time out, but that election looking like in terms of where One Nation will try and go and sort of, you know, focus their attentions?
One Nation will win every seat west of the Blue Mountains, every rural seat, the Nationals, Independents. I mean, there's a couple of Independents there who might hold on, but the National Party would be lucky to hold any of those seats. There's a key difference about New South Wales elections, which people forget. New South Wales uses optional preferential voting. You don't have to fill in preferences. The party with the most votes has a habit handing out one only how to vote cards, sending a message, just vote one. We've seen this message in the past. Labor will probably do that next year. The Liberals and Nationals have done that for the last two decades. I don't think they'll do that next year, but they then have to indicate preferences. Under full preferential voting, you tend to have to fill in the whole. You have to fill in the whole form when you're handing out a harder vote card. In New South Wales, you don't. The last election, neither One Nation nor the Coalition directed preferences. And for both of them, they had an 80% exhaustion rate. So there was no flows between the two parties. So if Labor's got the highest vote and Liberals, Nationals and One Nation are splitting the Conservative vote, Labor will win some surprise seats.
Surprise seats, you think?
Yes, because the preferences just will not flow between the non-Labor candidates.
Right. Okay. I get that. So basically these two state elections, of course, Victoria first and then the other one, are the kind of templates that at a federal level, and this podcast is more often federal, as you know, Anthony Albanese and his team, Angus Taylor, Matt Canavan, how can I forget the Nationals, because they're really going to be knocked off first, I think, out of all of the knockoffs. They'll be looking at these two elections to see booth by booth, suburb by suburb, the stuff that you look into, what's happening, what people are actually prepared to do on ballot papers, right?
Yep, and that's the key thing. It's how will that vote translate? I mean, I suspect the problem for One Nation is their vote is concentrated in a way that doesn't turn into a lots of seats. The Labor Party has the advantage, its vote's more even, it has a better chance of turning its vote into seats. That flow of green preference is so much stronger than the flows between the two, between One Nation and the Coalition. Of course, I mean, if the economy continues to sort of struggle, you know, limp along, it's not in recession, but it's just in this sort of complex period. People have got cost of living issues. The price of petrol has come down, but it's about to go up again because of the change in the tax. Those sorts of things will rumble along. But as we saw some of those things there before the last election, and at the end of 2024, I couldn't see how Labor would actually maintain its majority. I didn't see the Coalition getting a majority, but I couldn't see how Labor would get its majority. And in the new year, it just rolled along and the whole focus changed once you're into the campaign. That's what I think the question is. When we come to the next federal election, will the mood still be there? And particularly with Victoria, if One Nation does well, if they do well in New South Wales, how will that respond? I always say One Nation did well at the last two state elections in the upper house, before there was a terrible row and Pauline Hanson sacked the state executive of One Nation, sacked Mark Latham as leader, and now there's no One Nation MPs in the upper house. Pauline Hanson, when visiting South Australia after the election, said she wasn't going to interfere in the South Australian branch. But there's always been that problem with One Nation of that internal dynamic and bitter fights and the strong hold that Pauline Hanson and the people around her have over the overall party. There's no One Nation leader yet for the Victorian election, you'll note.
I've noticed that. And that's the thing, right? I mean, we don't have a presidential system in Australia. Everyone that I've spoken to has told me that Pauline Hanson as a figure, she's been in public life for so long, she says a lot of things people agree with, not all, but a lot of things, that she's quite popular. And so at the moment I mean, someone confirmed this to me this week, that the Labor strategy is don't go Pauline Hanson directly, go after the ideas. Ultimately, it'll be going after the candidates. I think that's really interesting that the strategy will be, yeah, you might like her, but you're not going to get her here. Is that?
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. In the last couple of elections, it's been clear Labor tends to know more about their Liberal and One Nation opponents than the parties themselves know about their candidates.
That's so true.
There's something to do with vetting there. And so that's a useful strategy. Also, just running the, I mean, I said I'd cover the 2001 Queensland election when Labor ran these ads with Pauline Hanson trying to drive the car from the back seat. It's that sort of thing you can play on instability. And it certainly was an issue in Queensland. The party's been around a lot longer now, is a lot more popular, so perhaps it may not work as well. But you can be certain that who the candidates are and what sort of instability you get out of the system will be interesting to see.
Mm. The other thing is that you said in the last pod I remember is, you know, historically, every time they've been tested to win big, their systems have failed them, their vetting has failed them. You know, they've been basically dealt or they've created their own hand, which is problem after problem. That appears, at least superficially from the outside, not all of us are insiders here on this, but from what we see, to have improved. That's really important for them, isn't it, Anthony?
I think it's partly the way that media has changed. Is that One Nation has worked out how to use the modern methods of communication, which isn't trying to get the best story in the news and appearing on 7:30 report and those sorts of things. It's about picking on a message and sending it out to the people who are interested in what you're standing for. Now, whether you can keep that up for another 18 months, I'm not sure. At some point, something will sort of... Pauline Hanson felt she had to come out and try and explain what she meant by monoculture, for instance, this week, when everyone's watching the Socceroos. So there may be some of those things where some of the messages she said at the press club lunch were over a broader population than just narrow casting. So
that's
there's
right.
The difficulty that comes up there, but they have vastly improved their communications.
Vastly. It's been just seismic. It's huge. Just finally, federal seats to look at. Well, I don't think I can ever, 2 years out from an election, ask you to kind of call anything gone. But what are you looking at?
I'd say if you go back and look at the last election and look about the outer suburban and regional seats the Liberals were talking about winning, none of which they won, they're the ones you would look at for if One Nation can knock them off. Your Hume, which is Angus Taylor's seat, it's not a rural seat anymore. It's a metropolitan area just around Camden. Lindsay, Central Coast seats, Newcastle seats. You're looking at Corangamite, the sort of regional Bendigo, Ballarat, maybe some in the western suburbs of Melbourne, maybe some in the southeast. Regional Queensland, the metropolitan Brisbane, which isn't in the Brisbane City Council. Any regional seat would be at risk. And nearly all Liberal seats. There's some of the outer suburban ones are Labor held, but outside of the metropolitan area, and Hunter is the last of the old mining seats that Labor still holds. They've lost Capricornia, they've lost Kalgoorlie, they've lost all those seats that used to be the great mining bedrock of the Labor Party, but they've been losing them for years. And Hunter's the last one, but they have a very good sitting member in Dan Repicoli.
Yeah, and actually, local MPs matter here, don't they? Because as you mentioned with David Farley, who clearly was really well suited to the seat of Farah, who they actually end up choosing is going to be key as well.
Yeah, and it's interesting that Newcastle, there's a seat there called Paterson, which has been a traditionally marginal seat. The Liberal Party held that for years because, you know, advertising on regional television is pretty cheap. The Liberal Party just flooded the Newcastle television footprint with ads for Bob Baldwin. The Liberal candidate member for Paterson. You can see that sort of tactic work in those areas because it's name. In a regional seat, you need to know the name of the candidates. And that's a really important thing. And that's where One Nation will have to put a bit of work into some of their candidates in some seats. But certainly you'd expect the Labor Party will be highlighting who their sitting members are a lot in those regional seats.
They certainly will. They'll put a lot of attention on all of that. Just finally, this is a party that's been really, you know, in different manifestations, but always led by Pauline Hanson, been on the sort of national stage now for basically 30 years. You've watched so many elections. How much is that part of its success? Because really, it's a leading question based on my own view. I think their name recognition is such a big part of this story. You see new parties try. It's very hard to be a new party. they've been on the landscape so long, Pauline Hanson kind of has almost waited it out till her time has come, right?
Yeah, they know who she is. That's what I was saying about Victoria. They haven't got a leader yet. They're going to have to use Pauline Hanson to sort of buttress their campaign because she's the known quantity. So I think that's a really important thing, that they know who she is. They know what she stands for. I think the difficulty they have is who she is and what she stands for may only be a minority opinion. It may get them to 30%, but to get into the government reminds me a bit in the 80s when the Nationals finally got control of Queensland in their own right. They acted as though they were going to win next time, but when their vote dropped off, they suddenly needed those Liberal preferences again. One Nation may do very well, but they do rely on getting Liberal preferences if they're going to win, Liberal and National preferences. So I think the problem they face is they may be well-known, they may get votes, but whether they get enough votes to be able to end up with more seats than the Coalition, or whether they can do well enough and get strong enough preferences from the Coalition to turn their strong primary vote into something that delivers a majority of seats.
Anthony, you know how much I love hanging out with you. Thanks so much for joining us on Politics Now.
It's been a pleasure.
And David Spears will be back in the feed for Insiders on Background on Saturday, speaking with former Liberal Senator Amanda Vanstone, who served as Minister for Immigration and Multicultural Affairs of Australia, on how the Liberals need to face the One Nation challenge. That will be very interesting. If you've got a question for Fran and I, send it to thepartyroom@abc.net.au, and we will make a special episode where we answer your questions. See you, Anthony.
Thanks.